Hello, this is Terry Malloy here to read The Week, the best of U.S. and international media for August 23rd, 2019. All you need to know about everything that matters. Our cover this week has shows an elephant in the gallows. Make America Great is what his cap says, and he's getting tomatoes and everything thrown at him. Shaming the GOP. Is it wrong for the left to out Trump donors? Main story this week is Epstein's final escape. International news, Hong Kong's battle for civil liberties. And our obituary this week is Giving Voice to the Black America, Toni Morrison. And we begin with our cover story with controversy of the week. Shaming Trump donors. Fair game or out of bounds? Since when did it become acceptable to target private citizens for their political opinions? Said Carol Markowitz in the New York Post. Liberals have worked themselves into such a moral outrage over President Trump, they think anyone who donates money to his 2020 campaign is complicit in this great evil and therefore fair game. Last week, droves of outraged blue staters canceled or claim they canceled their membership to Equinox and SoulCycle, the high-priced New Age Y fitness centers, because Stephen Ross, billionaire owner of both gyms' parent company, hosted a fundraiser for President Trump in the Hamptons. Just days earlier, Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro, presidential candidate Julian Castro's twin brother and campaign manager, tweeted out the names of 44 San Antonio residents who had donated the maximum $2,800 to Trump's reelection campaign and accused them of fueling a campaign of hate that labels Hispanic immigrants as invaders. In the current polarized atmosphere, this retaliatory intimidation is dangerous, said Guy Benson in townhall.com. Castro's clear goal was for anti-Trump partisans to find and punish these people for their political beliefs. The same hypocritical liberals who blamed the El Paso massacre on Trump's incitement are now circulating hit lists of Republican donors, including the home addresses of retired people. What Castro did was not doxing, said Suzanne Nossel in the New York Times. That Twitter era term means the unauthorized sharing of your political opponent's private information, unlisted phone numbers, home addresses, names of children's schools, etc. A person's history of political contributions, by contrast, is publicly available information in our democracy, and rightly so. As long as it never crosses the line into harassment or menace, calling out people for their donations is absolutely fair game. Trump's donors deserve to be named and shamed, said Zach Cheney Rice in nymag.com. They're giving their money to ensure a two-term presidency for a virulent bigot. The less shaming of Trump supporters won't work, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. Trump's fans don't think he's a racist, and don't think they are either. But they do believe that liberals are out to get them, using charges of racism and white supremacy to drive them out of polite society. These shaming campaigns will only rally Trump supporters to his side. The true believers may feel that way, said Michael McGough in the Los Angeles Times. But those who supported Trump for cynical reasons, such as their gratitude for his tax cut for corporations, may find the charge that they are actively funding Trump's xenophobia, hatred, and racism a hard argument to refute. These two cases aren't the same, said the New York Daily News in an editorial. It makes perfect strategic sense for socially conscious gym-goers to let Stephen Ross know that lending big dollars to support an unstable, dangerous, and divisive president may have consequences for the bottom line. But the people shaming of individuals who gave Trump less than $3,000, that's a path toward endless civil warfare. With his constant Twitter role of his opponents, Trump bears some responsibility for this, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. But in insisting that anyone who supports him is unworthy of an even minimal respect, liberals are turning their backs on the basic rules of American democracy. As both sides gear up for the 2020, the nastiness to come will likely make Castro's tweet seem like a church picnic. Our main story this week is Epstein's final escape from justice. What happened? Attorney General William Barr vowed this week to get to the bottom of serial sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's apparent suicide inside a federal jail cell, as members of Congress demanded answers as to how the wealthy financier was left alone after a previous attempt to kill himself. The FBI opened an investigation into what Barr called, quote, serious irregularities, unquote, at the Bureau of Prisons-run Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan. Early reports suggest the two guards overseeing Epstein slept on their shifts, then falsified logs. Epstein had been placed on suicide watch July 23rd, when abrasions were found on his neck, then was taken off 6 days later at the request of his lawyers. Guards were supposed to check on him every 30 minutes and house him with a roommate, but his roommate was transferred Friday night and not replaced. Hours later, Epstein was found dead after apparently using a bedsheet tied to a top bunk to hang himself. Senator Ben Sasse, the Republican from Nebraska, said Epstein's dark secrets were allowed to die with him, and that heads must roll. In the wake of Epstein's death, President Trump provoked outrage when he retweeted a conservative comedian's allegation that former President Bill Clinton somehow engineered the hanging because Epstein had information on him. A Clinton spokesperson said the former president knows nothing about Epstein's crimes and had not spoken to him in well over a decade. Meanwhile, there were news reports that Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, a British socialite described as his procurer, had boasted of possessing dirt on an astonishing number of rich and famous people, and even videotaped visitors to his infamous Caribbean island near St. Thomas. The FBI raided that island this week in search of evidence. About 80 women and girls, some as young as 14, have accused Epstein of raping or sexually abusing them. What the editorials said. While Epstein cheated justice with his death, the investigations into his crimes and those of others connected to him must continue, said the New York Times. Nothing short of a full accounting is required to restore faith in a system that too often tilts towards the powerful at the expense of the vulnerable. The public officials who have repeatedly failed Epstein's victims are a long overdue for a reckoning. Trump is playing a dangerous game by peddling conspiracy theories, said the Miami Herald. Not only is the president, who socialized with Epstein in the 1990s and early 2000s, and publicly called him a terrific guy, undercutting his own Justice Department investigation into Epstein's death, he's also exploiting the unending pain of Epstein's victims to deliver another nonsensical partisan rant to his base. What the columnists said. Epstein's death leaves prosecutors with one prime target, said Mark Fisher in the Washington Post. The Paris-born, Oxford-educated Ghislaine Maxwell, 57, met Epstein less than a year after her father, a British publishing tycoon and member of the parliament, died $4 billion in debt. His victim, she said, became the prime organizer of his thrice daily massages from underage girls recruited on the pretext they were auditioning for modeling jobs. In court, documents released just before Epstein's death, one of Epstein's victims, Virginia Roberts Guifier, said Maxwell had recruited her and ordered her to have sex with Epstein and numerous famous friends, including Britain's Prince Andrew. It shouldn't be possible for a hideous monster like Epstein to game the American system of justice, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. But that's exactly what he did. Again and again, the wealthy predator enjoyed advantages and breaks unimaginable to anyone who didn't jet around with influential friends. His high-priced legal team got him a slap on the wrist for a 202 guilty plea and even just got him removed from suicide wards. What a rare opportunity missed, said David Graham in the Atlantic.com. Since the 2008 financial crisis, Americans have left feeling they are two sets of rules, one for ordinary Americans and another for the rich and well-connected. Epstein's recent arrest looked like a chance to finally hold rotten elites to account, with this pampered child rapist likely to spend the rest of his life in a jail cell. Instead, his death represents one final escape from accountability. The White House sets new hurdles for legal immigrants. What happened? The Trump administration moved aggressively this week to cut legal immigration with a new rule making it harder for immigrants already here lawfully to become permanent residents if they use public benefits. Starting October 15th, green card applicants could be rejected if they've turned to public benefits for more than 12 months of any 36-month period. That includes any of a wide array of programs, including most forms of Medicaid, food stamps, and public housing assistance. Immigrants could also be denied if officials determine they're likely to use such benefits in the future. White House aide Stephen Miller was driving force behind the new rule, with the anti-immigration hardliner reportedly telling officials to prioritize it above everything else. The policy could reduce the number of people who receive green cards and visas by half, with the government estimating that the status of roughly 382,000 immigrants could be immediately affected. Defending the rule, Acting Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Ken Cuccinelli, said the Emma Lazarus poem inscribed at the base of the Statue of Liberty was meant for Europeans and suggested that if it should carry a disclaimer, "Give me your tired and your poor," Cuccinelli said, "who can stand on their own two feet." What the columnist said: the idea that President Trump only opposes illegal immigration turns out to be a big surprise, a lie, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. The new rule forces legal immigrants to make an impossible choice between accepting benefits they might desperately need or gaining permanent residence. It also privileges immigrants from Europe while making it harder to come from the poorer, browner nations. Trump denigrates as S-hole countries. This is just another part of Trump's crusade to make America white again. This isn't about race, said Jonathan Tobin in the New York Post. It only makes sense to screen out immigrants who can't support themselves. In fact, the idea is an old one. The new rule is based on the Immigration Act of 1882, which says the government can deny residency to anyone likely to become a public charge. The Trump administration has simply expanded and clarified the definition of who comes as a public charge to make it reflect our modern world. The idea that if someone has ever used a public benefit, then they won't ever become a contributing member of society is absurd, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. Almost 1 in 6 Americans used food stamps during the Great Recession. The immigrants who arrived at Ellis Island a century ago did not, for the most part, come here on private yachts or in first-class berths, said Joel Mathis in TheWeek.com. But they and their descendants strengthened the nation. Today, immigrants are no different. Their children are just as likely as any other U.S. adults to be homeowners and more likely to be college graduates. Somewhere, Emma Lazarus is weeping. China blames U.S. for Hong Kong protests. What happened? Fears were mounting this week that China would launch a military crackdown in semi-autonomous Hong Kong after pro-democracy protesters temporarily shuttered the city's airport, and Beijing began massing paramilitary forces nearby on the mainland. Thousands of protesters, some waving U.S. flags and singing, "Do you hear the people sing?" from Les Miserables, swarmed the airport for several days, causing hundreds of flights to be canceled. It was the boldest act of defiance yet by the 2-month-old protest movement, which was sparked by legislation that would have allowed Hong Kongers to be extradited to the mainland, but has grown to include demands for greater democracy. The airport occupation descended into chaos after the crowd beat up 2 men from mainland China, one a reporter with a state-run newspaper, and riot police rushed in. The next day, protesters held up a sign that read, quote, "We apologize for our behavior, but we are just too scared," unquote. Chinese authorities described the demonstrators' actions as close to terrorism, and satellite images showed some 500 armed personnel carriers parked at a stadium in the southern city of Shenzhen, which borders Hong Kong. President Trump tweeted that U.S. intelligence agencies had confirmed that Beijing was moving troops toward Hong Kong and that everyone should be safe and calm. Chinese state-run media said the protests were being guided by the black hand of the U.S. and that the CIA was trying to stage a color revolution, like those that erupted in former Soviet republics in the early 2000s. What the columnists said. The odds of a Tiananmen Square-style crackdown are rising by the day, said Richard McGregor in the New York Times. Beijing's displays of fury and firepower are meant to intimidate the protesters into retreating, but a vicious cycle has now taken hold. Images of police battering peaceful protesters with batons and tear gas have made some protesters embrace violence, in turn provoking more iron-fisted policing. China's strongman president Xi Jinping won't tolerate these embarrassing scenes for much longer. Soon he will resort to force. Rhetorically, it's not even clear what side the U.S. is on, said John Daniel Davidson in TheFederalist.com. Trump has been content to offer platitudes such as, "I hope it works out for everybody, including China," and Democratic presidential candidates, too busy eating corn dogs and pandering at the Ohio State Fair, have been largely silent. The protesters waving American flags passionately believe in American freedoms. The question is, do we? Trump's response has been almost comical in its emptiness, said Jonathan Last in TheBulwark.com. But what is he supposed to do? If he supports the protesters too loudly, Trump will add fuel to Beijing's claims that the demonstrations are all a foreign plot. If he applies no pressure, he will only embolden the communist regime. Too much pressure, and he could make Beijing desperate. And desperate regimes are violent regimes. America, sadly, can do little to protect the brave souls on the streets of Hong Kong. Obituaries this week. The Nobel laureate who chronicled the Black experience. Toni Morrison, 1931 to 2019. Toni Morrison gave voice to millions of people who had long been relegated to the margins of American literature and life. With poetic and often painful language, the Nobel Prize-winning author placed African Americans, particularly women, at the heart of her 11 novels. Many of Morrison's characters were tortured but proud figures, who were, she said, unavailable to pity. They included Seth, the runaway slave and beloved in 1987, who commits infanticide rather than see her daughter raised in bondage. Pecola Breedlove, a black girl who struggles with feelings of racial inferiority and longs for eyes like Shirley Temple in The Bluest Eye in 1970. And Macon Milkman Dead III, who spends decades searching for his roots and identity in Song of Solomon in 1977. Slavery and its brutal legacy coursed through her work. Anybody white could take your whole self for anything that came to mind, Morrison wrote in Beloved, which was set in the 19th century, but read as a metaphor for the 20th. Not just work, kill or maim you, but dirty you. Dirty you so bad you couldn't like yourself anymore. What drove Morrison to write about the African-American experience, she said in 2003, was the silence. So many stories untold and unexamined. There was a wide vacuum in the literature. She was born Chloe Ardelia Wofford in Lorain, Ohio, to a shipbuilder father and homemaker mother, said the New York Times. Young Chloe grew up in a house suffused with narrative and superstition. She listened to ghost stories and folk tales told by her parents, both of whom were descended from slaves, and watched as her grandmother ritually consulted a book on dream interpretation. At school, Chloe developed a love of literature, especially the novels of Fyodor Dostoevsky and Jane Austen, who went on to study English and classics at the historically black Howard University in Washington, D.C. Classmates struggled to pronounce Chloe, so she started going by Tony, from the baptismal name Anthony, patron saint of the poor and the lost. She had taken on converting to Catholicism at age 12. Soon after earning a master's degree from Cornell University, she joined the Howard faculty, where her students included the civil rights activist Stokely Carmichael, said the Washington Post. In 1958, she wed Harold Morrison, a Jamaican architect. Their marriage was an unhappy one, with Harold believing a wife should be subservient to her husband. "I was a complete nuisance to mine," she said. Morrison started writing fiction to escape, said the Times in the UK. "I wrote like someone with a dirty habit," she explained. "Secretly, compulsively, slyly." One early short story was inspired by a childhood friend who, Morrison said, confessed to losing faith in God because she had prayed for and not been given blue eyes. After getting divorced in 1964, Morrison moved with her two young sons to New York City, taking a job as a senior editor at Random House. Over the next two decades, Morrison would cultivate what she called a canon of black work, editing books by Angela Davis, Tony Cad Bambara, Gail Jones, and Muhammad Ali, and African authors including Wole Soyinka and Chinua Achebe. In her late 30s, Morrison began working in her own novels, writing whenever she could find time, said Time. She wrote at daybreak when her boys were still asleep and would scribble out paragraphs on her steering wheel while stuck in traffic. Her debut, The Bluest Eye, was set in 1941 and inspired by the Black is Beautiful movement that took off in the 1960s. There was a time when black wasn't beautiful, she said, and you hurt. Her next novel, Sula, 1973, focused on two childhood best friends whose lives radically diverge. Like many of Morrison's books, Sula captured the importance of black sisterhood. It was so critical among black women because there wasn't anybody else, she explained. We saved one another's lives for generations. Nationwide acclaim came with A Song of Solomon. It was picked as a main selection by the Book of the Month Club, the first novel by a black author to receive the honor since Richard Wright's Nature's Native Son in 1940. But it was Morrison's fifth novel, Beloved, that proved to be her most celebrated work, said The Hollywood Reporter. In a chilling feat of literary invention, Morrison gives words to the slain infant who lives as a ghost with her mother, a symbol of the bloody history that continues to haunt African Americans. "I am not dead," says the child known as Beloved. "I sit, the sun closes my eyes when I open them. I see the face I lost. Seth's is the face that left me." The novel was an instant sensation, sending 23 weeks on the best seller list. When Beloved failed to win a National Book Award in 1988, 48 black writers, including Maya Angelou, Ernest J. Gaines, and Alice Walker, wrote an open letter protesting the oversight. Later that year, Beloved won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, the first of many major awards for Morrison. She received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993, the first black woman to be so honored, and in 2012 was presented with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian award in the U.S., by President Barack Obama. The accolades didn't cause Morrison to slow down. She won acclaim for the improvisational style of jazz in 1992, which was set in the 1920s Harlem, an echo to the strains of black jazz music, said the Daily Telegraph in the UK. More novels followed, as well as three children's books. Well, that's it for this week. This is Terry Malloy, wishing you a great week ahead. I'll be back next Sunday to read the week.